Good evening, everyone. I'm glad you've come. Our series tonight in Science Fiction Writers of Michigan starts with Mr. David Feintuck. He grew up in New York, New York, attended the Harvard Law School, and in 71 he moved to Lansing. Before becoming a full-time writer, David had been a photographer, an antique dealer, and an attorney. He has a stately Victorian mansion furnished entirely in antiques except for his writing room, which has every electronic toy one could possibly find. An inveterate traveler, he has had a lifelong interest in naval history, sociology, politics, and medieval European history. David is the author of the Seaport Saga, beginning with Midshipman's Hope, for which he won the science fiction John W. Campbell Award as Best New Writer in 1996. The series also includes Challenger's Hope, Prisoner's Hope, Fisherman's Hope, Patriarch's Hope, and Voices of Hope. The Still, his most recent, at least at this point was, his new book is A New World of Fantasy Adventure. The young Crown Prince of Caladan must count on the loyalty of his noble friends as well as test his own courage and strength to reclaim his throne from his evil uncle. I'd like to have you join me in welcoming David Feintuck.
Thank you. And I'm glad to be here. This is fun. I noticed that the flyer said readings and discussion. We're here to talk about my favorite subject, which is me and what I write. But I don't like to read because readings always seem to me to be, I mean, you got to pick out some small piece of it. If you're reading a short story, you can get the whole thing. When you pick out a tiny bit of a novel, it's either the beginning, which is just setting things up, or it's right out of the middle and you have no idea what's been going on before. So I generally don't read, because I think it's kind of frustrating for everybody concerned, including me. I would tell you, though, a few things about what I write and why I write. I used to go to the bookstore, and I began to discover, this will happen to you as you age, that all your favorite authors are dead. I mean, you know, Robert Heinlein was one of my real favorites, and Rex Stout, writing mysteries, James Thurber for humor. They're not around anymore. They're not putting out anything new. And it got harder and harder for me to find something I really liked. And I would get very frustrated about this. And finally, when I did decide to write, which is something I thought about when I was young, and I actually did write a complete novel when I was young and then never submitted it. I showed it to some friends who all said, oh, you ought to submit that. But I didn't. I found, about 2 years later, I found my novel, my idea, in the stores. Somebody else had gone ahead and written it, and I did it better. But of course, by then it was dated. Anyway, when I did get around to writing, I wrote for one reader in mind, and the typical 6'4" attorney living in a small town in Michigan, who was frustrated as hell going into bookstores and not finding anything. That was the reader that I wrote for. And I wanted sometimes you read a novel and you say, yes, I got that just right. This really satisfies me. I wanted to achieve that reaction in that particular reader. And I did. Now, it took me a while to get the book to the point where I was really, really happy with what I'd written. It took many drafts, many submissions, and many rewrites. But now I can look back even on my first book, and it rings my bell. Okay, I get emotional at all the emotional points. I get excited at all the action points. It does everything that I want. Now, of course, the question was, having written it, would anybody else feel that way? Because, you write a book and you submit it to somebody and you're saying, here is my soul. look at it and tell me what you think. And what you what you're afraid they're going to do is say, yuck. Because when you first write something, you are absolutely convinced that every thought you've ever had is completely revealed in your writing, that people will know you more intimately than anybody else could possibly know you. It's a very frightening experience to submit a novel. Because, you know, in fact, I'll tell you how frightening it was. Back when I was in college, I had an English professor, and I thought a lot of him. And so we had an assignment, and I wrote a short story. And I suppose today you would call it a snuff story. It was about a teenage kid who ran away from home, jumped on a freight car, and got assaulted and killed by somebody he met. And I handed it in to the teacher, and the teacher, I waited to get it back, you know, and the teacher handed it back to me. And I said, well, he said, we won't discuss this. He said, everybody makes mistakes now and then, and I'm not going to hold it against you, but we won't discuss this. And I didn't write again for years. As it happens, I found out later, years later, that he had a son who was gay but had not come out of the closet, and something about assaulting the boy must have triggered in his mind some fears. But that pompous ass, I mean, he turned me off of writing and made me feel that there was something dirty about exploring things that made him uncomfortable. And I don't really forgive him for that. But, you know, what happens if you write a novel and an editor says, you know, yuck? Well, actually, they don't. They just say, thank you very much. It doesn't suit our needs at the moment, you know. And they don't even address it to you. It's a form letter. But it's a pretty scary thing. Why did I get into writing? Well, I always wanted to, and I was determined when I got out of school that I would go write. But I guess I found something interesting. I didn't have anything to say. Now, it's not that later on you say, I've got something to say. I mean, people do. They may say, you know, despoiling the environment is terrible. So I'm going to write a novel that shows that. And I think these are people who sell their birthright for a pot of message. And it's really a shame because, like... was it who said that, was it Cecil B. DeMille or one of Louis Mayer in Hollywood, if you want to send a message, use Western Union, you know. The writing should, you know, what you read should be entertainment. If there happens to be a quiet and subtle message in it, that's all well and good, but if that's the purpose of writing, forget it. Well, what I wanted to do when I wrote my first novel was explore an idea. I was sitting around, minding my own business, flicking channels, you know, 75 channels and nothing's on, and I'm just going in this rotation, and I came across Lifeboat, which is an old Alfred Hitchcock movie about people trapped in a lifeboat. I must have watched it for all of 15 or 20 seconds before going on to the next one, but as I was flicking channels, you know, through QVC and these horrible networks, I began to think, you know, what would happen on a lifeboat or some situation like that, if somebody was in charge and they were incompetent and they knew it, and what was worse, the people that they were commanding knew it, and he was aware they knew it. I mean, what can you imagine, you know, how awful that situation would be? And I began to think about that. I said, you know, I've got a story here. And I turned off the television and I actually sat down to start writing. I said, okay, now what do I do? I mean, I had tried to write a novel before, and it was, you know, a few months before. It was a complete disaster. I turned out maybe 1,000 pages and the thing wasn't half done and it was not terribly coherent. And I realized I didn't have the craft yet. So I was working on craft and working on telling a story. I said, well, how am I going to set this story? Well, it's pretty... If this has to be interesting, I'm going to catch the reader. I can't, for example, have the chairman of IBM be incompetent because nobody would care. I mean, I suppose we'd care today if the chairman of Microsoft was incompetent. But, you know, it couldn't be just a business story. It couldn't be an incompetent housewife. I mean, it has to be life and death. Well, where do you get life and death? Military. Okay. So set the thing, you know, in the South Pacific somewhere. Well, the problem is we got radios. And today, anytime the military is involved in something, they, you know, ET call home. And the White House tells them exactly what to do. You know, it's not even done in the Pentagon anymore. You know, the guys in the White House Situation Room are sitting around giving detailed instructions to the guys in the field. I said, all right, well, that won't work because he'll say I'm incompetent, or the people he's commanding will say he's incompetent. They'll relieve him. So we have to have a situation he can't be relieved. How do we do that? Isolation. He can't call home because he's isolated from home. Well, how do you get isolated for a long period of time? There was one era in our history where that happened, and that was the Age of Sail, the British Age of Sail. You know, it might take in the early 1800s only, you know, 4 or 5 weeks to go across the Atlantic, but when a ship left home port, it might not return to that home port for as long as 3 years. And it could be a full year, especially if we went around the Cape into the Pacific, it could be a full year before they hit another civilized port. That is, with a British consul and an arm of their own government. All right, so I could set this in the Age of Sail, and it would be a life and death story. I began plotting it out, and I said, you know, there's going to be one little problem here. I know a lot about the Napoleonic era. I love the old sea stories. I'm going to write this thing, and if maybe someday I got it published, which was way beyond my dreams at that point, but if I did, I was going to start getting letters, and they were going to begin, "Dear sir, you idiot. Everyone knows the mainsail jib is attached to the halyard spar, not the forecastle." And they'd be right, because I didn't know enough, and I couldn't research enough to get the details of sailing exactly right. I mean, there are people who would know. Patrick O'Brien was one of them. And in fact, that's really all he gave you was excruciating detail of the period. But I couldn't carry that off, and I couldn't learn enough out of books to carry that off. Well, now, how am I going to do this? How about if I set my story in a navy that hasn't happened yet? Nobody can write in and say, this is not what the ship looks like, you idiot, because the ship hasn't been built yet. It's not going to be built for 200 years. Let them write to me, you know, 200 years from now. See if I care. So, all right. And then I began thinking, well, what kind of world would support, why doesn't this guy just quit? Well, it's a word. He gave his word he wouldn't. Well, so what? People give their word all the time these days. It doesn't mean anything. Well, in his society, it does mean something. Why? Well, he's very religious, and he swore an oath. People believe that. Well, the whole society is like that. So now I began seeing a society that was a religious hierarchy in which an oath and honor really counted, and the rules were, right there in the manual, you can't quit. Why can't you quit? Because society must not want authority to quit. Why not? Because it's a very strict hierarchy, very authoritarian, and the captain of the ship represents them. They don't want the captain just saying, okay, I don't want to do it anymore. The government cannot abdicate. So now I see this world developing wherein we have a strict religious hierarchy, strong sense of honor, and a naval environment in which the captain must go on. He is not allowed to recognize his fallibility and quit, but he ought to for the sake of the ship. This is starting to make an interesting story, and the world built itself. All I had to do was justify it. What kind of Navy? We're not going to be in the British Navy. How about the UN Navy? Well, we don't have a UN Navy, but maybe we will. So I looked at the geopolitics and the economics, and I said, well, what happens if, you know, America's power fades? What happens if the UN becomes a world government? What happens if the British are the first to throw in this new government and they become very influential in it? And we have the traditions of the British Navy. And the whole story really built itself. And then my lead character just came to me. As I started writing him, the first day I wrote, I found his name. You know, names are very important when you write. Sometimes I just grind to a halt because I realize this guy has the wrong name and I cannot finish the book till I fix that name because I see him in part through his name. And Nick Seifert just developed, Nicholas Ewing Seifert, who is my protagonist. And I began to understand his world. He was young when he got on ship. He's a very young kid. This happened. I had to explain why you have to be very young and you're sent out into space. It has to do with hard radiation and a disease that you're less subject to if you're exposed to the radiation within 5 years of puberty. Okay, now you got kids on the ship. And it all started to work out in my head, and I plowed away, and I finally, some months later, finished the novel, and I have to tell you, it was dreadful. I mean, because I've always been a raconteur. I mean, I can tell stories and have people in stitches if I really want to. But that's not the same as writing it. It's not at all the same as writing it. Writing is a completely different skill. I mean, there are all sorts of tricks you have to learn. One of them, for example, is that talking is different from writing. And I've seen a lot of writers try to write as they hear people talk. How are you? Well, fine. I'm like going to the store, and I'm like, you know. And they have all the ers and ahs and hesitations and repeats, echoing, which drives me crazy. Sometimes you see a writer do this. Where are you going? Out? No, where are you going? Out. Out? Why? Why? Because I want a cigarette. A cigarette? I mean, every sentence picks up the last word of the sentence before, and you want to bat the guy over the head and say, stop that echo. I can't stand it anymore. Well, these are things you have to learn, and I hadn't learned any of them. So I began to write and rewrite and rewrite, and finally I thought the thing was good enough to send out, and I sent it out, and it came back, I think, the day before I sent it out, and it was so fast. But, you know, while all this was going on, I was going through some rough times. My marriage was coming apart, and I had to travel on business, and I was stuck out in the middle of malls taking pictures of people. I mean, this booth right in the plunk middle of the mall, and I'd set up, and I had my little laptop with me. I had an early laptop that weighed about as much as a locomotive, and but it worked. It ran WordPerfect, which was all you could ask for. And, you know, I started showing the novel to some of the people that I worked with in the malls, and they liked it, and I began thinking about it. And, yeah, I had nothing else to do. I wasn't getting anywhere on this one. So I started another story about the guy because he wouldn't go away. He really started to fascinate me. So I started Challenger's Hope. And I worked for that for several months, and pretty soon that was done. And now I had two novels, and I still sent the first one out. I finally said, okay, not doing any good to send it out by myself. I'll send it to an agent. Where do you get an agent? Well, there's Writer's Market. That in that year, the agents were listed in the back of it. I think now you got to buy a separate book, but it was in Writer's Market then. All right, how do you pick an agent? You know? The dartboard approach, yeah. Well, you look to see if they've ever done any science fiction. So I picked five agents, churned out five copies of my book, sent them out. One came back, moved, left no address. One came back saying, thank you, but no thank you. One came back saying nothing at all. And two went out into the void and were never heard from again. You know, there's a catch-22 about becoming a writer. In order to be published, most companies today, with only a few exceptions, require agented submissions. Now, agented doesn't necessarily mean a licensed agent. Actually, there is no license, but it does mean a professional agent member of the association. It can also mean a cover letter from a real writer that they've heard of, or an editor that they've heard of, that says, you really ought to look at this seriously. I mean, that is the equivalent of an agented submission. But you really needed to have an agent. And you know what? To get an agent, you have to be published. Because they, you know, what has happened is the publishing company, it's called the slush pile. You people have all heard about the slush pile. In hundreds of excruciatingly bad manuscripts come in unsolicited. And the publishers, who no longer want to spend the money to read them, have said, all right, let the agents spend the money to read them. And the agents promptly raise their commission from 10% to 15% and gritted their teeth. And some of them started reading them. But, you know, you can only do this so long. And a lot of them said, wait a minute, unless you have some track record, you know, don't even bother me. I don't want to read things from people who are unfamiliar with the English language. And so, oh, you have no idea how bad they are. I have been a teacher for Writer's Digest School, among other things, and people send me stuff all the time just because they know who I am. I was talking to Gardner Dozois, who is writes the year's best anthology each year, and he edits Asimov's magazine. I said, you know, what's it like reading this stuff? And he says, you have no idea. I said, is it like the Eye of Argon? I mean, dreadfully, dreadfully bad. He says, no, it's not that good. He said, the thing about the Eye of Argon, which is a famous manuscript, supposedly the worst ever written. In science fiction conventions, they pass it around and see how far the reader can get reading aloud without breaking into hysterical laughter. I mean, it is just god-awful. And says, no, the problem is that was spectacularly bad. Most of the stuff isn't spectacular. It's just dreary and soul-killing. It's just awful. And he's right. It is. I mean, you get things like, look out, he spoke. Have you ever read a book? You know, do you know that they don't put that in books? Well, okay. Anyway, I don't know how I got so far afield, but my stuff was probably similar to that. So I wrote the second novel, and I did feel that if I was going to write a second book, it had better be better than the first book, because otherwise, why bother? Because I have always hated reading a great book from somebody and I rush out to buy their next one saying, well, it's almost as good. What a letdown. So I finished that one, still not published, and I said, all right. And after a bit, another idea came to me. So I went out and wrote Prisoner's Hope. Now, remember, when I wrote Midshipman's Hope, it was the end. It had an ending. The end, goodbye. You have that sense of resolution. Ah, it's over. You know, thank God. And then did the same thing with Challenger's Hope. It was the last book I was ever going to write. I mean, how I'm not getting published. Why do I keep writing? I did the same thing, and I wrote Prisoner's Hope, and all of a sudden, halfway through, I stopped. I said, I have an ending here. Wow, I can't wait. And I sat down and wrote out this final chapter, this ending. Trouble was, even as I wrote it, I knew this was not the ending to the book I was writing. Which means, oh, shit, I got to do a fourth one now. But I finished Prisoner's Hope, and I said, how is this book going to end? Is it going to be more spectacular than the last one? And I found an ending that it was, and I knew that the ending to the fourth book, Fisherman's Hope, was a killer. And I said, this is where it stops. I cannot possibly write another book because the ending to this is so strong, I will never beat it. And it was. I mean, it was really, really strong. It was grim. And I finished it, and I had all four of them. And that was it. And I was submitting them and got nowhere. And all of a sudden, in about 2 weeks, miracle happened. I had made contact with a wonderful writer and editor named Ardith Mehar, who lives in Texas. And she helped me with my first book. I said, I think it starts slow, but otherwise I think it's good. And she sent me back a 6-page single space letter that basically said, yeah, you're right. It starts way too slow. You got to do something with the first 100 pages. But once that story takes off, it's like a rocket. And, you know, so it cost me $1 a page to send it to her, $700 through the mail to somebody you've never met. That's pretty scary. And if you want to be a writer, you got to pay your dues. You know, you got to go through a lot of crap and you got to take a lot of risks. And this is one I took, and thank God. Anyway, I sent her the rewrite, and I was waiting for another letter. And what came back was a letter to a lucky editor. This is to introduce the work of David Feintuch. I think this is a wonderful book that should be a great asset to your list. And we started submitting it. And at the same time, she referred me to an agent. And he was reading all four of them. He said, if you've written four books, I want to see them all. So, okay. I mean, because she had referred me, he knew that it wasn't just slush. So I sent all the books, and he was plowing through them. And all of a sudden, one of the companies I talked to, you can only submit to one at a time, and I submitted to Ace. And the editor there, Susan Allison, actually, when I called 6 weeks later to find out if they'd gotten it, you know, she answered her own phone. Well, this is unheard of in the publishing industry. You usually get a secretary who won't even tell you who the science fiction editor is. I mean, you know, these people lead stealth lives because they are inundated with slush, and they don't want some guy calling and saying, you know, can you tell me why you turned down my manuscript 3 weeks ago? It was just like Star Trek, and it was really, really good. It had Klingons and everything. And so they don't want to go through that. So but she answered her own phone. And I told her, she said, well, give me another week and call me back. Okay, I gave her 2 weeks and called her back. Well, she said, I guess I'm going to have to pass on it. I said, oh. And she said, oh, please don't sigh, she said. I said, you don't know how much I was hoping this would be the one. I said, is it the writing? Is it really that bad? You see, you never get to talk to these people and find out what they don't like. All you know is you get this letter, and it's a form letter. They don't say, you know, if they were interested, they might say, clean up this particular part and we'll buy it. But if they're not interested, you don't know why they don't want it. It's infuriating. It just keeps coming back. I mean, you know, so people send them to me and say, why didn't they want it? Because it's dreadful. Well, that's all you can think. Anyway, she said, look, the problem is it is a coming-of-age story, and we have a lot of coming-of-age stories. I don't see how we can put a cover on this book and sell it and make it stand out from the other coming-of-age stories. She says, the writing is good. I like the writing. And I said, okay. And I hung up, and I drove wherever I was driving to, and wait a minute, damn it. And the next morning, I called her back, and I said, look, if you were telling me the truth, and you really felt the writing was good, and it was just that it's a coming-of-age story, I happen to have written another book in the series, and he's all grown up, and this one is not a coming-of-age story. Would you like, you know, perhaps just send it to me? And I did. And then I called the agent, and I said, you know, are you interested in representing me? And he said, I haven't finished all four yet. Let me finish all four. But if I had to give you an answer right now, it would be yes. Oh, goody, I'm going to get an agent. I get a phone call from the editor about 3 weeks later. She says, well, we're interested in buying them both, and she named a price. I had been struggling for years to get a book published. Now she's going to buy both. So I called the agent and I said, I have an offer. Now, if you want to represent me, you know, he says, what's the offer? And I told him, he says, what? He says, we can do better than that. I guarantee you we can do better than that. As it happens, you know, I talked to him. I said, you know, the problem is I've written 4 novels. What happens if they buy the first 2 and they don't do well? I have 2 novels that aren't going to sell. And he said, well, we could take them somewhere else. And I said, what happens with this offer if we take them somewhere else? He says, they may renew it and they may not, but they're under no obligation to. Now, after working for years to get 1 novel published, I just turned down an offer for 2. This is what I mean by paying your dues. If you don't have an ulcer, you haven't paid your dues, okay? This is really tough. Well, I sweated it out for about a month, and he took the books to Warner Books, Time Warner. And he had to do some horse trading on some side issues, and suddenly they bought all 4. And they put them out. It took about a year of in the publication process, but then they came out every 4 or 5 months apart. Normally, books come out a year apart. So now they're still going to be in the bookstore when the next one comes out. And I have 4 books coming out in sequence that people can actually see in the bookstore. It was wonderful. They took off like a rocket. Midshipman's Hope is either in its 10th or 11th printing. I don't know which one. And somewhere in the middle of the process, I went to WorldCon, the World Science Fiction Convention, and was given the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, which is one of the 3 big awards. Maybe the only award I ever get, but that's enough. That's fine. And of course, what happened was, having finished Fisherman's Hope, I knew I could never write another book in that series, because that ending was so damn strong that nothing was going to beat it. I mean, it was just fantastic. But you know, I had this idea. What would happen? And there was a part of an ending that I had wanted to put into Fisherman. No, that's not true. I just had another idea. I said, you know, this guy has a son. What happens if his son is a little older? How do they act? How do they interact? And I started another book. Well, Voices of Hope, I knew it wasn't part of the series. So I said, it's not going to be first-person narrator like the others. This is going to be different people telling the story. But I'm not going to stick with 1. I'm going to go 5. And each one is going to be a different kind of person, different voice, different language. Well, the book got finished. Here it is. Will I ever try that again? No. Could you pay me enough to make me do that again? No. It was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. Getting the action to where, and see, these guys are in sequence, A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E. So it's not just pick a character and start talking for him. There's 61 chapters, essentially 60. So each person goes through 12 narrations. To have the action ready for him when his voice comes up, so that he is there and he can say, I'm seeing this, I'm doing this, at the right moment, was dreadfully difficult. On top of which, I had to invent 3 different versions of a dialect, plus a couple of fairly well-educated people. Holy mother, I would never do that again for anything. And anything. Anything. Do you see these marks where I was banging my head against the wall? It was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I carried it off, and the ending was really, really big. And I wrote 2 endings. In one ending, he dies. And the other ending, he lives. When I finished writing this book, as in all of them, I was a complete basket case. Because there are very strong emotions in my book. If any of you have read any of them, you will know that you feel a lot of emotion. Well, you read a 2 or 3 page sequence takes you maybe 3 minutes. When I'm writing that sequence, it takes me hours. I am experiencing those emotions in slow motion, which intensifies. I would come down from my writing room and find my daughter, who was about 17 at the time, and put my head on her shoulder and cry, because I just had to get that out of my system. It was just so strong. So I said, do I kill him? And I showed the two endings to people. Well, of course, the editor says, don't kill him. But that wasn't why I didn't kill him. It was just that I really felt that I had dragged people through 5 very intense novels. And ending with killing him was just too unfair to the people who had stuck with me. So I took the happier ending and saddened it down a little bit so it wasn't quite as joyful. So that it fit the rest of the series. And good, I had finished the series and I was done. No more. Never gonna write another of these things. And in fact, I gave myself another project. I said, I had read a wonderful book, and you know, I don't know the author, I can't keep it in my head, but the name of the book is The Sheriff of Nottingham. It's a great retelling of the Robin Hood story, from the sheriff's point of view, wherein he's the hero and Robin is the villain. It's a great story, but he starts out by creating this medieval world in which, I mean, he talks about the bishop and the shire and the reeve and how the fields are laid out and who has no possession of what and who runs the castles, and you can hear the clop of the horses and you know all about the gear on the horses and the bridles. And now, I had always said I'm never going to write a fantasy. Fantasies, I mean, I love Tolkien, and once upon a time I even liked, you know, Donaldson. But the rest of this stuff is such awful derivative crap, I'm never going to demean myself by writing a fantasy. But when I read that book and it came alive, I said, I've got to do that. So I said, all right, I'm going to write a fantasy, and there is going to be no magic sword, no magic ring, no volcano, no orcs, elves, dwarves, masters of evil, no thunder over the castle on the hill, no wizards, none of that stuff, just a fantasy. So I wrote the still. It is entirely different from anything else I've ever done before. And I tried to put an ending on it so there'd be some sense of resolution, but the story really wasn't done. So sometime next year, the second and concluding volume will be out. It will be called The King. It's already been sold. This hasn't been written yet. I've got about half of it. Well, I wrote about a third to a half of it, and then I jumped ahead because I had the ending. And when you have an ending, always write it down, you know, because then you have something to aim for. And I had an ending that I thought was pretty cool. So I wrote the ending. I know that the story is over and there can't be another one, there won't be another one. And I don't really want to be a fantasy writer, but it was interesting. I handled the character completely different. Nick Seifert is just so caught up in his own sense of responsibility. You know, he really has to carry out his duty. And the protagonist of the still is a spoiled brat, and he could care less about duty. He had to have some really hard knocks. I've heard there's some dents in some walls here and there where people threw the book, you know, across the room because they couldn't stand it, because they hadn't gotten to that point yet where he redeems himself. But he eventually does, and I like the kid. So that was that, and now what do I do? And I was fiddling around with something else, and I had 2 or 3 projects I started. None of them worked out, and I was getting desperate. I had lost a year of writing, trying to write stuff that wasn't happening. Well, you know, Nick Seifert's still there. But wait a minute, that ending and Voices of Hope, I could not possibly top. Could I? Well, you know, what's interesting about Voices of Hope is it ended with a certain scene. And it was not quite the scene I'd originally envisaged for the ending. It was similar, with a ship going towards destruction, but it wasn't quite the way I wanted. I said, you know, I have an ending that's probably even better than this one. I mean, I really couldn't have fit it into that book. It wasn't going to work. I have an ending. What kind of book could I write that would lead me up to that ending? No, I'm not going to do this. I'm not. But whatever else I tried to write just wasn't going anywhere. And so in desperation to keep the writing juices going, I started this book called Patriarch's Hope. It has a good ending. And I think that I have kept faith with the readers. And because I knew this was the last Seifert book I was ever going to write, I brought on all the old characters, which I never do. Everybody got mentioned who had been in a previous book. If they were still alive, most of them showed up for a final bow, you know. And, you know, think of the end of the play. They all come out, they take their bow. This was just basically their last. And I sent Nick Seifert off into the wild blue yonder, and it was over. You idiot. Well, as you know, it didn't work out that way. And there's another Seifert book coming out in April. This is interesting because he's not the narrator, but I learned something in Voices of Hope where he was supposed to have just a little walk-on cameo and the book was supposed to be about the next generation. What I discovered is if Nick Seifert elbows his way into a book, he is the central character. Nobody else has to like it. That's just the way it's going to be. I mean, I didn't want him to be the central character. And so I kind of knew by the time I got to this one that he was going to end up being the central character. But it's kind of like the camel, you know, being a creature made by a committee, or the blind man describing the elephant or something. I mean, everybody sees him differently. And that's the fun of writing it this way. I can have other people describing who they think this guy is. And everybody sees a different aspect of him, but yet they correlate. They're not all, none of them are wrong. They just, none of them see the whole picture. So there's going to be another one, and this time I actually had some trouble with the ending. And so I called my agent and I said, you know, I got 95% of the book written and I don't have that big bang, and I can't submit a book that isn't going to top the ending of the previous one. This is a very good agent. His name is Don Moss, and he's head of the Agents Association this year, and he's very hot now. He wasn't when I first met him, but he is very, very well respected now. And he just dropped everything and said, well, what if, and he started throwing ideas at me really, really fast. That's beautiful, because you know by the ones you say no, that couldn't possibly work, that gets, but this would work. You know, it gets your juices flowing. And I said, wait a minute, what if? And then he says, yeah, and you could. And I said, well, now, well, wait a minute, what if? And inside of an hour's conversation, I got the picture of the ending I needed, and it's good. I think it tops the others. I don't know how I did that. But of course, there is never going to be another Seifert book, because I can't possibly beat this ending. And since I can't, I'm never going to write one that I think the ending doesn't beat it. You know, if I hadn't come up with the ending to this, I would not have submitted it, because I will not write a book that I don't think keeps faith with the readers. The other thing I try to do is when any character shows up again, have any of you read the Hornblower books? C.S. Forrester, some of you have. Well, okay, C.S. Forrester wrote this wonderful series about Captain Horatio Hornblower, who had a sidekick, whose name was Lieutenant Bush. I think his first name was Lieutenant. If he had a name, I certainly have no memory of it. And Lieutenant Bush kept going through a half a dozen or more novels. All of a sudden, right plunk in the middle of the novel, in a scene that has nothing to do with the action of the novel, he is sent ashore on a little skirmish. And you hear that he was blown up, blown to pieces. And, you know, you read this and why? What does this have to do with? Well, I know why. because Forrester got so damn sick of writing Bush and Hornblower, Bush and Hornblower, Bush and Hornblower, that he couldn't stand it anymore, and he just got rid of the guy. You know, go off, stand in front of a cannon, buddy. Boom. Okay, and that's the end of Bush, and now he wrote Hornblower with no Bush. So, if I have somebody reappear in a second book, you see something different about them. They come on in a different way. A lot of my characters will do that. Very few characters will show up over and over again. But anybody who shows up for a second book, you see something about them that is consistent with what you knew before, but different. Now, I don't know what it's going to be. It's really hard. Okay, I think I've told you everything I know about this guy in the first book. And now he's going to show up again, so I got to make him a little different, but completely consistent. How do I do that? You know, it's a trick. And I mean, it's a real challenge. And I don't know, usually, that it's going to work. But it always seems to manage to. And these are important things to me as a writer. I'm going to wind up in a minute and let you guys ask questions, but these are important things to me as a writer. One is to reach you emotionally. That's more important than to wow you with funny science. I mean, I read a book, and these are by award-winning guys. I read a book recently, The Resolution Depends on Your Buying Into This, that to save us from, I think it's a planet coming towards Earth, we send a whole bunch of nanomachines into space, and they reach the moon, and they use the lunar rock and whatnot to reproduce themselves and eventually build this device that's going to deflect the planet. And oh, by the way, in the same time, the two heroes of the book lose their lives, but that's okay because their consciousness and personalities go into the internet and they become internet creatures. Well, you lost me about the third curve there, okay? I can't read a book like that and appreciate it. Science fiction community seems to have no trouble with that kind of stuff, but not me. I read another one recently where the resolution requires that you believe that a bunch of geniuses, this is not a space opera either, a bunch of geniuses get together on an island, of course, and they develop a virus that acts like the cold, spreads to everybody, and changes humanity down to the cellular level so that you can take in nutrition by either eating, by rolling around in old leaves and bark, or by, by photosynthesis, by just being in the sunlight. And this happens about 50 years from now. I'm sorry, it may be a good book, but don't ask me to appreciate it. I'm not interested in goofy science. I'm not interested even in extrapolating current science. So maybe I'm not a science fiction writer. I'm probably in disguise that British naval sea story writer who tried to write, you know, that first novel. I came to science fiction by accident and because I always loved it. As a kid, I devoured every piece there was. But what I want to do is make you cry. I want you to have a lump in your throat when you read my books. I want you to care. I want you to know that if you like one of my characters, there's no guarantee he's going to make it to the end of the book. Okay? Unlike, you know, a lot of series books. You know they're going to survive. With my books, you don't. I want to challenge your thinking. I want you to wonder what is right. I mean, what I'm proudest of in Fisherman's Hope is I posed a really strong moral dilemma and I didn't take sides. I didn't tell you what was right. I still don't know for sure. But I know that you had to think about it to read that book. Those are things that I want to accomplish in my writing. And in order to do that, I want to keep my own writing as invisible as possible. As a stylist, I want to have no style at all. Doesn't mean I don't want to write well. To me, that is the essence of writing well. When you say, oh, what a cute phrase, you know, what inspired language, you're looking at my language, not my story. I intend to be, and I try to be, a storyteller, and that's what I try to do best. And the story that I want to tell you, I want to move you. If I move you, I've connected with you. It's been worth my life of writing. And so there's a lot of pain in my books, and some of it is very personal. I understand the pain that I write about. And that's who I am, and that's what I do. What I'm going to do is try to wind down and then give long-winded answers to any questions that any of you come up with. I cannot, just like I can't write a short story, I can't answer a question short. I don't know why. I've tried. It doesn't seem to work. So somebody throw something at me just for fun. Yeah. What do you think being a lawyer brings to your writing? He asks. A sense of sleaze. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a recovering attorney. L. Warren Douglas is a very good writer who is an anthropologist by training, and you can see the anthropology in his writing. You can see how he looks at a culture in terms of its roots and its history, and it just comes out in everything he writes. My training was in the legal field, and it comes out in terms of how does a society mesh? How does it work? How are its rules? How do people act with the rules? In Midshipman's Hope, there's a whole subplot. What did the regulations mean? Is a midshipman an officer? Well, it says this, and it's ambiguous. And you know, I'm able to create a pretty good ambiguity because I know what is legally ambiguous. And I think a lot of my writing has to do with how the person works in relation to the constraints of society, which are laws. I mean, Nick Seifert is very often skirting the law. He doesn't ever want to break it. So he becomes expert at, for example, giving an oath that he is able to live up to literally, but never in the way that the person who demanded that oath of him expected. But he hasn't broken it. He's just found, you know, a new interesting way of interpreting it, or he'll make a promise, and he'll keep that promise literally, not the way people expect it. And I think being trained as a lawyer, looking for loopholes, you know, when you're trying to get a drunk driver, you know, through a really bad case, you know, and you're looking for loopholes, you know. And this is the kind of thing that attorneys are good at. And it has affected how I write. I see things not sociologically so much as in terms of the politics of the issue and how somebody is constrained by laws. So that wasn't too bad, only about 5 minutes. You know, I'm going to take it as a real insult. If you don't find any questions, it means I bored the hell out of you. And in that case, I'll never be back. Which you wouldn't mind if I bored the hell out of you, would you? Anybody? Ferris? Yeah.
How's children's book out on the shelves?
April. Some week in April. This is not the real book. This is the cover, which I got at Worldcon. My editor rushed it to me, and it's actually over another book, but it will be out in April. It's finished. In fact, I have with me today a piece of the copy-edited manuscript. That, you know, the process involves you write the book. They write you back a letter saying, how about this, 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 and this? So you rewrite the book. And then, I mean, I don't mind. I love to rewrite it. What I hate is the deadline that stops me from rewriting, because I'd rewrite it 20 times if I had the time to do it. And then they send the rewritten book to copy edit, in which a copy editor goes through and catches commas. But I have a wonderful copy editor. In fact, I've asked for her for 6 books in a row. After I think it was my first book, she said something to me. She wrote, when I say said to me, she wrote on one of these little query slips, "You mention 23 or 18 crew members. on page 36. You mentioned that there are 18 crew members. Over the next 79 pages, you have 23 names. Not the next page. Over the next 70, she kept track. And this kind of fact-checking is worth its weight in gold. So I have had her, I've insisted, and these are independents. They don't work for the publisher. Oh, and simply, I never finished my story. Time Warner bought my books, and I stayed with them till this very last one, and I signed a new contract, and now I'm with Ace Books and Susan Allison, who is the woman who first offered to buy my first two. So I came home at last, I suppose, which is, I guess, how she feels, too. And kind of fun to go full circle. But this will be out. It's in copy edit now, and in about 5 days from now, I have to turn it in. The next step will be they'll send me galleys in which they take the copy edit manuscript. They really work from a disk I give them and make all the copy edit changes and send me something god-awfully atrocious with, pages reversed and paragraphs dropped. And then I get to go over that again. You're not supposed to make changes, but I do. I mean, up till the moment of publication. Yeah?
So my question is, you wrote several books of science fiction. For example, when you watched the movie Star Trek, say, what is the expert point of view? Do you consider that maybe they use too much computer graphics instead of the content?
Most people, when they hear the word science fiction, they assume we mean movies or TV. No, I can't. We use a different kind of sleight of hand, and it's basically the same way a magician works. You say something very loudly here, and you very quietly stick something in your back pocket with the other hand. It's almost like computer graphics, and it's called foreshadowing. If I'm going to have there's an old adage in the theater which says that if you have a gun hanging on the mantelpiece in Act 1, somebody better fire it in Act 3. Well, the reverse of that is if somebody fires a gun in Act 3, you better have it hanging on the mantelpiece in Act 1. That's foreshadowing. You don't have the gun suddenly come there when it's needed. You have to have told the reader in some quiet, subtle way that it's there, but you have to do it. If you're a really good writer, you do it in a way the reader doesn't notice that you've told him that it's there. Otherwise, he knows how the book's going to come out. Well, that's our version of computer graphics. When you ask me about TV and movies,
some visual effects, sound effects, I think it becomes artificial sometimes.
Yes, honey, you may not interrupt. Go back to your seat right now. Right now. Right now. I hate what they do on television and movies. I'll tell you my two or three worst bugaboos about that, what I just can't stand. Why in space, in vacuum, do they bank the ships on a turn? Why, when the asteroid or the great ship goes by, the camera is in this ship, and the other ship is going by somewhere else, do you hear the rumble of the engines through vacuum? Okay, any medium that has these conventions, I don't take seriously. Now, 2001, the first movie, was brilliantly done. He came up with ideas and possibilities, and they carried it out in a very scientifically correct way. There was silence representing these things. And then you look at things like Apollo 13, wonderful movie. In fact, I didn't know it was computer graphics till I saw a couple years later, I saw a How It Was Made type film. But I thought when that thing took off that somehow they had a camera at a real takeoff. It looked so real to me. It was wonderful. But most science fiction in television or movies is crap. People ask me, what would you like to see most in a movie, in a science fiction movie? And the answer is from a novel by David Feintuck, of course. But I suspect it would still be crap because that is how the medium. It requires so much simplification. You can't tell a whole story. I was fascinated by Starship Troopers. I liked that movie. I saw it 4 or 5 times. I think it's silly, but I liked it. Okay, I can like silly stuff as long as I'm allowed to acknowledge that it's pretty dumb. But you know, they took all the ideas out of Heinlein's wonderful novel. It was really a good novel. In fact, as it happens, 30 years ago or more, when I was in college, I wrote my senior thesis for political science comparing Starship Troopers to Plato's Republic, which Heinlein happened to crib the whole book from. And, I mean, just word for word, line for line, he translated it. I think he sat down and said, nobody's ever going to read Plato's Republic. Why don't I translate it for them? That's the kind of thing he would have done. I mean, you know, he's bright enough to do that. So why don't I put it on a level they'll understand? And even the image, there's a famous image in Plato's Republic of somebody in a cave. I don't remember how it works. They're seeing the figures of the people outside by shadows, you know, from the firelight on the cave wall. Even that Heinlein borrows, image for image. So I know Starship Troopers, you know. And every one of the ideas in that book is eliminated in the movie. And that's what made it a good movie. But, you know, that happens all the time. I happened also to have liked The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. And the movie they made of it was remarkable. It didn't have a single idea. It had a very nice blonde that Gary Cooper was interested in, and that was the story. And this wonderful novel of ideas by a fairly unusual woman, she wasn't always right, but she had interesting ideas, and you at least had to think about them, was completely gone from the movie, and that's what movies do. So if you're going to watch a science fiction movie, you have to accept that. I mean, Armageddon is a fun movie. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed, what's the other one, Sudden Impact, or is it, or Something Impact? Huh? Deep Impact. I enjoyed that too, but, you know, it's not real. I mean, it wouldn't work like that. And you just have to accept that movies are going to dumb it down and concentrate on computer graphics. And remember that the average moviegoer they want is, you know, age 14 to 22. Those are the male. So you got to have a lot of testosterone in these films. You gotta have a lot of action, and that's what they're making the films for. So I can still enjoy them, but I don't take it seriously. And one of the things I hate about going to a convention is, you know, some people think that media is all it is. We authors are just kind of wander around like ghosts in another dimension. You know, oh, books? Yeah, I suppose. You know, okay, whatever. I mean, I get tired of seeing Klingons every, you know. Get a life. There is no Klingon language, you know. Do something else. You know? So.
With all that being said, is there any thought of making
chicken soup? The option was sold, but nothing came of it, so we'll see. One can always hope.
Is there going to be any more Nick Secret books?
Never again. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I know that the very next thing I'm going to write is The King, which is finishing the sequel to The Still. There are some people in the Nick Seifert world who don't leave me alone, and I don't know what's going to come of that. I would like to write something more. I don't want to be known only as the guy who did Nick Seifert. I would also like to write other stuff. There is a pretty big novel that I started and I put aside a couple years ago, which I may go back to, which is an entirely different universe. But it's science fiction. It's not fantasy. I'm glad I wrote fantasy. It gave me a way to express something interesting that I never would have done otherwise. But I don't see myself as a fantasy writer. For one thing, fantasy requires a lot of description, and I am lousy at description. I'll tell you what I'm good at. I'm good at dialogue and emotion. My dialogue is as good as anybody's out there, and I do real strong emotion. I don't do very good description. What happens, I write the story, and then I go back with this big basket full of extra words, and I plunk a few here and there, you know, adjectives mostly, and occasional adverbs, you know. And you enrich your sentences to try to make it more interesting, which I had to do a great deal of in the still, and any fantasy, especially medieval period one, requires a lot of world building. It requires a lot of, you know, you got to get the pungent aroma, you got to get the glint of the swords, you know, and the sweat on their foreheads and everything to make that come real. So it's not my specialty. It's actually rather hard work for me. So I suspect, I know the king will be the next one out, and then I know that it'll either be, God help me, another Seifert, which I hope it won't, or a more contemporary science fiction novel. I've always wanted to do an end of the world story, and I've always wanted to do an alternate history. What I don't like about alternate history is that becomes the whole purpose of the story. No, I really like Harry Turtledove. He's a good man, and he is certainly a successful and well-respected writer. But when I read his stuff, as well as all the others, okay, so the South won the war. Now you just follow, this is what happened to Lincoln, this is what happened to Booth, this is what happened to these other guys, this is what happened to you know, the Southern generals. Where's the story? What do you care about? Where are the characters you invest in? And it'll be interesting to try to do an alternate history that doesn't have that flaw, that really has people you care about just happen to live in a different world. So that's something that's always struck me as a project I might tackle next. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, Sheckley, and he's still writing. Yeah, Sheckley is still writing. In fact, my agent is his agent. He wasn't one. Pohl and Kornbluth and Fred Pohl, who is a really he's quite old now, but he's a good guy. He impacted on me. Heinlein more than anybody else. And I really liked Asimov, but with great restrictions. Asimov wrote interesting ideas and didn't have a clue about people. And you see this in his writing. I think it is noteworthy and sad that Isaac Asimov's most famous character, most highly developed character, the one with most personality, is a robot, R. Daniel Oliva. He could not write people. In his early stuff, he tries to do the average Joe's having this humorous conversation, and you know, you grit your teeth and just try to get through it. He doesn't understand how people talk. He doesn't understand average people and their humor. And so you know, you read him for different reasons. Heinlein got most of it right. As he got old, he developed a problem with oxygen to his brain. He had an artery plug. He ended up having an operation where they ran a new artery right up to the side of his head to restore the flow to his brain. And his books, his last two books, I think, were far better than the two or three before that. He had become, it wasn't quite senile, but he was ill. And his last stuff was no good until maybe the last book or two. But when he got it right, he got it so right. You know, when I sat down to write, I said to myself, there are two ways of writing, and I call them Heinlein and Asimov. Asimov says, look, I got an idea here, but I don't want to be bothered wasting my time filling in the backstory and telling you how the society got here and having it all fit in. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to start out with an excerpt from the Encyclopedia Galactica that is, you know, a page or two or three, and it's going to give you the whole story. So you're going to know everything about the world this takes place in. Yeah, we got that crap out of the way. Now I can go on and do what I want to do. Heinlein knew that you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to tell people the whole backstory. You've just filled in pieces as you needed it. And, you know, no place in Midshipman's Hope do I sit down and say, this story takes place in a world where there's a strong religious hierarchy that was established in the year 2042. You don't need that. You just need to get a sense of the world by how people are acting. And when you need to know something, you find it out. And I never said, I'm going to imitate Heinlein, but what happened is Heinlein's ways made such obvious sense to me that as I started writing, I began writing in that style. It was so clean. And so I'd say that Heinlein was probably the biggest single influence, but the old Galaxy magazine. I mean, yes, I got analog, but Galaxy at its best was just great for a teenager. If you go back and find old copies of in the late 50s and 60s, that was good reading. There weren't great stories, but they were exciting and they just kept coming. And they were probably the leading magazine of their days. It's a shame they didn't make it financially, but for a while they were the top magazine. And that's where those are probably my best sources in terms of. I liked it a lot better the first two times. I did buy the expanded version, and I couldn't tell where it had been expanded. It just seemed a little over long. I think the cuts that had been made were good ones. You know, very often when you get these director's cuts. Any of you have DVD? I have DVD, and I buy movies, actually, and then deleted scenes. Very rarely do I find a deleted scene that I wish they had left in. Most of those deleted scenes should have been taken out. It's not, they're either overlong or they stray in some fashion from the point. It's true for a lot of the stuff that's cut from books. Stranger was exciting. I wanted to be Jubal. I remember in the 60s reading that thing, I wanted to be that guy. I was going to law school when I read it, too. But this guy would take on anybody. He had no fear of anybody. He was a lawyer who just, you know, went after society if it got in his way. And he did it, you know, all for the right causes. I mean, not for money, but for... I admired that guy. And, of course, Heinlein, it was a fantasy more than science fiction, because he's saying death isn't real, death doesn't matter. You get beyond death. And that's, of course, a very appealing thing to hear at any age, you know, that this all isn't going to end. And so it was certainly a milestone. It opened up science fiction to things science fiction never was able to do before. And I loved it. I remember reading it two or three times back then when I was younger, and then I went back about 5 years ago and read it again and got less out of it. But, you know, part of the problem is it's been done since. You go back and find things that were done the first time that are new and exciting. Well, everybody does that. Yeah, they do now. But when he first did it, nobody was doing that. And that's the, you know, it's... You can't recapture that excitement, I suppose, when you see what everybody does afterwards. So, no questions? Yeah?
What do you say to someone who, for instance, they would pick up Midshipman's Hope, they finish it, they say that was a great book, and then you discover, oh, you mean there's six others?
Well, actually, I haven't gotten that. If they finish it, most of them say, oh, there's six others. I get a lot of fan mail, and most of it is pretty positive. I don't say anything to them. I say, you know, if you don't want to read it, don't read it. But you see, my books end. My books have an ending, so you don't have to. And in fact, you can pick up something in the middle. You started with Challenger's Hope, which is unusual, but I set them up so that I tell the backstory a different way in each book. How do you fit in what happened before? Don't have to tell every detail, just enough for somebody not to be lost. Well, I found a different way of doing it in every book, and it's really fun, you know, trying to find a way I hadn't done before. But you can pick up any of these books and read them alone, And you don't have to start with the first, but whenever you want to stop, there is an end to the story. There's no cliffhanging ending. I hate a cliffhanger. You know, Hyperion, who wrote Hyperion? Simmons, is it? Dan Simmons. I hated him. But then I found out it wasn't his fault. He turned in a 1,000-page manuscript, and the editor said, no, this is not a 1,000-page book. This is 2 500-page books. And they clopped it off in the middle at the end of a chapter, and this is book one, this is book two. Well, they should have told you. What I'm mad at is the publishing house, whoever it was, because you pick up this book and you get to the end, and there is no ending. It's kind of like Riverworld. You ever read Riverworld? Is that Farmer? Yeah. I read the first two or three, and I found the books don't end. I mean, you got to read the next one and the next one and the next one to find out how it's going to come out. You don't have a sense of resolution. That's not fair. My books have that. And because they have that, I feel, you know, if you want to stop, you can. It's not, they're not meant to be addictive in that fashion. You know, I think it's very unfair when a book doesn't give you a resolution. That's been pretty important to me all along. Yeah.
I wonder if I might have missed this because I was late, but I'm curious, in the secret novels, you have a sense of the British or the Navy sort of history that almost conveys an ideal. Like this is in acting it out, this is what it would have been like in the perfect sense.
Yes. I tend to be like that. I usually say what I mean, and I usually mean what I say, with very few exceptions. You know, my daughter's 21 years old, and I never lied to her, not once. It wasn't easy, but I have never lied to her. I never lied to my son. You want to sometimes, you know. And I won't say I've never lied to anybody, but that is my perception of an ideal world in which people mean what they say. And you know, I began thinking, what if somebody took an oath seriously? What if he meant every word he said and he really meant it down deep to his core? And that describes who Nick Seifert is. And I don't think it's so much the British naval tradition that's idealized, but the sense of honor, which could be from that era or any other. You know, if you say something and you mean it, how does that play out? And that may be part of being a lawyer, as I write. You know, what happens if you're bound by your oath? What happens if what the law says and what you mean, what you say, are real and literal? Because we say so much, I'll call you next week. I can't imagine Nick Seifert ever saying, I'll call you next week, unless he meant to call that person next week. It's just not his style. I try not to say that either. You know. But I think I would have liked to be Nick Seifert. I would have liked to have the challenge to live that type of life. And I don't mean the adventure. I mean the honor. But, you know, it's kind of like reading Ayn Rand. I loved Atlas Shrugged, but you can't live in that kind of world. It's not real. It's so idealized. For example, her characters never snicker. They may have an Olympian laugh, but they never do anything small. And, you know, it gets wearying after a while. I mean, I like it in a sense, but you can't really live like that. So I guess I can't get to be Nick Seifert. But the books are an expression of what if, you know, what if you could? Wouldn't that be cool? So. We are almost out of time. Does anybody have anything else they would add? We have a couple minutes. You know, it's fun talking about these books. I won't say it's fun writing them. It takes me about 6 months to write a book and 6 months to recover. Really. sometimes longer, and because I take it very seriously. I'm humorless about the process of writing, and I love to discuss the craft of writing. Any of you people want to, you know, not writers, but want to be? Nobody? Ah, we get the admission. Well, you know, it takes a lot of work, and it's worth the work. The sense you get of creation is wonderful. I had a writer say to me, you know, if I outline and I plan and I put this out, and then if I'm really lucky, the characters, you know, take the story away from me and write. Really lucky? Why would you write if that didn't happen every time? I mean, you know, what drives me crazy, I sold my last two books, well, like the sequel to The Still, The King. I had written a few chapters. I didn't have the ending yet. So my agent said, well, you know, just show them a sample chapter and a synopsis. Yeah, right. I mean, a synopsis, my synopsis is, and then something happened. If you want to know what it is, wait till I write the damn book. Don't ask me now. How am I supposed to know now? They haven't told me yet. And they're not going to tell me until it's written. Some people write quite differently. I know what I was going to say. If you want to write, what do you start with? Well, what fascinated me, I learned that you can start with any of many things. And the first one I started with a question in Midship and Soap. What would happen if somebody were in combat? What would happen if they knew and everybody else knew? How would that play out? And in Challenger's Hope, it was kind of like, where do these people go? What happens to them? What are their lives turn out to be like as they're older? In Prisoner's Hope, I had a couple of really key scenes. I saw almost visually, like a movie, you know, the scene of blowing up the station or one or two others. And I said, what kind of book has this scene in it? What kind of book has this scene fitting perfectly in it? That's a different question. You can always throw something in, but making it fit and be part of the book so that the reader doesn't say, wait a minute, he just veered off in left field here, which is what, you know, Piers Anthony would do that for a pun. He would move his entire plot. I remember the last time I decided I would never buy anything from that guy again because I'd be following along, and all of a sudden he thought of this great pun, so he would wrench the plot off course so he could get the pun in. Now, come on, give me. Fisherman's Hope, I had the ending. I mean, wow, what an ending. What kind of book ends like this? I saw that ending. In Voices of Hope, I had all these people. You know, they're all going to tell this story together and each show their vision of the elephant. You know, and together, you know what an elephant is. And in Patriarch's Hope, I had an ending. I had a great ending, and I knew that the book would reach that ending because everything that happened was designed to go there. You don't always have to have the same thing. It can be an emotion. I've started a book just based on watching a movie that really reached me. And, you know, I got tears in my eyes, and, oh, that's good, that's strong. And I got to write that. Does it mean I'm writing that plot? No. Does it mean I'm using that characters? No. What it means is I want to have that feeling. So I'm going to take that feeling and translate it into a different milieu. But it's that feeling that I want to write about. I understand that so well. That hurts so exquisitely. I mean, it sounds masochistic, but it isn't. Something can hurt well. That's why you go to tearjerkers, you know, in the movies, because you want that perfect sense of hurt. And so why I write, what I start with when I write, it can be anything. It's just something that I have to feel strong enough to say, yeah, turn on the computer now, and you know, get a few pages of it started so it'll be real. But one of the interesting things is I don't necessarily know what it is. I don't necessarily know where I'm going, and the books tend to have themes, and I don't know till I'm done. Like Patriarch's Hope was fathers and sons. Well, as it happened, my father was diagnosed terminally ill. And that was in the period I was writing that book. And I did not know that I was writing about fathers and sons till I got done. I said, wait a minute, there it is, all the way through. Every, you know, all these characters are doing this. And you know, these themes come out. If you trust your subconscious, I've had writers say, I can't write like that. I have to know everything I'm doing in advance. I'm thinking, what a pity. Because then your subconscious has so little opportunity to help you do that writing and to enrich it for you. You know, if you don't trust that part of your brain, then everything is seems to be rote and mechanical. And you start with a 1-page outline, then make a 10-page outline, then make a 40-page outline, then you write the book. And it's just kind of like fill in the numbers. And with me, I never know where it's going unless I've started with the ending. And it's quite an adventure finding out where they take it. So it is 9 o'clock. If anybody does not have anything further to say, I do have copies of the books here for anybody who would like them. I'm happy to sell them to you. That's one thing an author usually does, is bring his books anywhere he goes. So if any of you would like them, you're welcome to, and I thank you for sitting and listening.